Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 11. A door slammed on the side of the house, internal lights reflected off the ground in front of me, and I heard Pamela Winthrop shouting, "Did you leave the cellar door open, Hal?"
"No," came the familiar male voice.
"You told me not to."
"Well, then somebody's broken in."
"You're kidding!" Although I was curious to hear how Pamela would respond to her husband's exclamation, getting out of there as fast as possible was my first priority. Not only did I feel no desire to encounter the Winthrops, I felt equally disinclined to fraternize with the individual who'd shoved me out the window, the person now grunting as he squeezed his own, much larger frame through the small opening. By the time he hit the ground, I fully intended to be halfway home. And I would have made it, too, if one of the Winthrops hadn't turned on an array of outside lights and momentarily blinded me. By the time I recovered, McCarthy was dragging me toward the woods.
"My God, Pamela!" I heard Hal Winthrop shout while Jason barked frantically. "I can see them running through the woods. There's a whole gang of them."
His shrill cries cut through the night, and I shot up beside my running mate and would have passed him had he not gripped my hand so tightly. As it was, we kept up a swift pace that quickly put the lights of Journey's End behind us. Once that happened, I allowed myself to relax enough to take stock of the moonlit terrain over which he led us.
"McCarthy,"
I panted, disengaging my hand from his.
I think we should cross over to the other side of the road."
"Why?"
he puffed.
"Your place is on this side."
"I know. There are some low spots on this side and in the dark."
"I know what I'm doing," he snapped. He probably would have said more, and none of it very pleasant, had not the sound of the slowly approaching vehicle attracted our attention. He shoved me to the left.
We'll cut across country up ahead where the land drops off. We'll be below the car and the road there."
"But McCarthy..." He told me to be quiet, and I obeyed because I could, after all, have been mistaken. But I wasn't. When the vehicle's bright light swept the area in front of us, we were exactly where I feared.
"McCarthy, no!"
I whispered as loudly as I dared, but naturally he didn't listen. Like a mighty warrior leading the charge, he plunged down the incline and dragged me along with him. For the first 20 yards or so, I tried to convince myself that the swamp I remembered in that location no longer existed, thanks to global warming or some such thing. But the ground grew spongier and spongier, and soon our feet made revolting, sucking noises every time we moved. Clouds of voracious mosquitoes billowed up, and a symphony of swamp dwellers croaked, hooted, honked, and squealed their displeasure as the two of us slogged by. Soon we splashed through standing water, and I blocked out images of 300-pound snapping turtles and 10-foot-long, slime-covered snakes by trying to guess when McCarthy would admit his error. That answer came much too quickly to offer any distraction. Never. Then a battalion of bats swooped down to feast on the mosquitoes so suddenly, and McCarthy backed up so fast to get out of their way, he knocked me down. That did it.
"You moron!"
I hissed at him furiously as I sat in the muck.
"Don't you have any brains?"
"Don't I have any brains?" he hissed back, looking every bit like a swamp creature as he loomed over me in his dark jeans and pullover.
"You've lived around here for what? 20-odd years? Why the bloody hell didn't you tell me it was a bloody swamp?"
I leaped to my feet as best I could under the circumstances and angrily stamped my foot. It made such a disgusting sound, it infuriated me even more.
I'll tell you why I didn't tell you it was a bloody swamp.
I grabbed the front of his sweater with my muddy hands and shook him as hard as I could, a not particularly satisfying endeavor because I barely budged him.
Because, you bloody bastard, you don't bloody listen.
And with that, I shoved him as hard as I could and stormed off, too consumed by my rage to appreciate the resounding splat he made when he hit. McCarthy wisely kept his mouth shut for the rest of the hike to my place, which, thanks to his testosterone rather than brain-mediated plan, took twice as long as it should have. As we emerged from the woods into the clearing in front of my house, he broke the silence. "May I use your phone?" he asked with a politeness I knew required a heroic effort, especially after he opened his mud-encased cell phone and a tadpole fell out. I looked at his mud-caked body and then my own and knew that, under no circumstances, would I allow either of us to enter my house like that. "Only if you get rinsed off first." I gestured toward the hose coiled by my gardening shed, then picked it up and demonstrated the process. But I also picked it up so I could rinse myself off first, thereby using the sun-warm standing water in the hose. By the time I handed the hose to McCarthy, the water temperature had dropped precipitously. He gasped and probably would have clutched some especially vulnerable male parts protectively had I not stared at him with such a totally staged, innocent look on my face. Needless to say, my quasi-partner's mood didn't improve when he stood in my kitchen in a pool of icy water a few minutes later and got no answer when he made his call. He surely would have slammed down the phone had not the cat stared up at him, wearing a look of complete adoration.
What ails that beast?" he harumphed as Matty wrapped himself around his wet legs.
"Beats me," I shrugged, but made a mental note to ask Tony to give him, the cat, not McCarthy, although McCarthy probably could have used one, a complete neurological workup as soon as possible. My partner and I stood silently dripping in the kitchen until McCarthy shivered and the cat glared at me reproachfully. "Oh, all right." I grudgingly acquiesced to the cat and ignored McCarthy's baffled expression. "We might as well get out of these wet clothes before we catch pneumonia." McCarthy gave me such a complex look, I decided I didn't want to know what it meant. Instead, I directed him to the bathroom in the L extending off the back of the house, told him where to find Bob's spare sweats that still hung in the closet in the den next to it, and went upstairs to clean up myself. By the time I returned, McCarthy had put his wallet and other personal belongings on the table under the birdcage, where Matty examined them in minute detail. Meanwhile, the dogs ecstatically nosed through the wet clothes he'd piled by the door. The man himself cursed as he hung up the phone yet again and began to pace. Only my polite upbringing kept me from laughing at the way his long limbs extended beyond the cuffs of Bob's sweatshirt and pants. Rather than do that, I put on some relaxing classical music and brewed a pot of tea. When it was ready, I placed two cups on the kitchen table and invited him to sit down. "I thought I told you to stay home and clean house and bake cookies." Somehow this remark didn't sound nearly so formidable, coming as it did from a man in a much too small sweatsuit with a purring cat draped around his neck. "You saying this place is dirty?" I challenged him sweetly. He looked around the neat room and shook his head. I got up, took the lid off the cookie jar, placed a half dozen cookies, store-bought, but I knew he'd never know the difference, on a plate, and put it down in front of him. He looked from me to the cookies and back again. "What were you doing at the Winthrops?" Although I'd been dreading that particular question for hours, the fact that McCarthy posed it while trying to stop Matty from nuzzling his ear greatly diluted its negative effect. By the time he growled and dumped the adoring feline on the floor, I'd formulated what I considered a valid response. "Why were you?" I countered. "I don't want to play games." He emphasized this point by pounding the edge of his cookie on the table where it,
being one of those large, half-baked, chewy store-bought kinds, folded submissively. "Neither do I," I smiled at him encouragingly. "I was trying to do my job." He captured my gaze before I could look away. "Now, why were you there?" "I was trying to help you," I sighed. "Trying to help me," he repeated, gripping the cookie in a manner that strongly suggested he wanted to choke me. I found out there was a big do for the lake people in town, and it seemed like the perfect opportunity to look for the goat. I rushed to defend myself. "I tried to call you so you could do it, but you weren't home." "Do you really think Hal Winthrop would steal one of his own goats?" He gave me the oddest, slightly bovine look. "I sincerely doubt it." I easily rejected the possibility. "I just thought I'd eliminate his house from the list of possible goat hideouts for you." He relaxed his grip on his now unusually shaped cookie before he asked the next question. "So what were you doing in the basement?" "I told you, looking for the goat," I patiently repeated. "And I wasn't only going to look for it there. I just started there because the window was open." "Well, why were you making so bloody much noise outside?" His grip on the cookie started to tighten again. At first I had no idea what he was talking about, but then I remembered. "I was rattling dog food in a tin," I reported confidently. "What?" McCarthy's incredulous expression compelled me to describe my masterful plan. "A lot of domestic animals are conditioned to that sound and come running. I was going to do that and make goat noises." Here I bleated in what I considered a very realistic manner, given my limited exposure to goats. But then some cats and a shepherd mix came out of the woods, and, well, they looked so hungry, I gave them all the food. He put his head down and his hands on the table. "Could you give me a lift to my car?" his muffled voice asked a short time later. Until that moment, it hadn't occurred to me that he must have driven to the lake. As I put his wet clothes in a plastic garbage bag, I wondered why he didn't go to it when we fled the scene of our respective crimes. I still didn't know the answer when I dropped him off at the south end of the lake a short time later. "Where's your car?" I asked, scanning the area for signs of it. "I hid it over there." He gestured so vaguely, I knew he was lying. "You want me to stay here until you're sure it's all right?" I volunteered, strictly to irk him. "I want you to go home and stay there," he semi-snarled, then strode purposefully off into the night, with his sack of soggy clothing slung over his back, looking like a cross between Santa Claus and the Blob. I couldn't stop laughing as I put the car into gear and eased back onto the road. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.